Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth.
Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear an interview with Dr. Ann Sheets, a Chicago-area physician, to discuss the debate in the United States in 2009 over healthcare and a proposed single-payer healthcare system. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Google is expanding its book search service to include millions of new titles. People will be browsing, purchasing, and reading digital books in record numbers. And in some ways, having a vast digital library at your fingertips is good news. But some of the details of the new digital book business are troubling to privacy watchdogs. There's a difference between owning a paper book and purchasing that same book in digital form, says Cindy Cohen, legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
These new transactions that we're starting to have are presented as if you're like buying a book, but you're not actually buying a book. You're buying the right to access a book under certain specified terms that are generally significantly less than what you get when you buy a book.
One of those specified terms have to do with consumer privacy, which has Cohen very worried. Google will have access to a vast amount of consumer information. They'll be able to monitor the books you search for, what pages you linger on, and what you buy. EFF is partnering with the ACLU of Northern California and the Samuelson Law, Tech, and Public Policy Clinic at the University of California to press Google to take steps to protect privacy.
We have strong protections for our reading habits when we're in libraries, and bookstores have generally stood up for strong protections for purchasers of books, too. There's some very famous cases about this. And all we're asking Google to do here is to take a very public and enforceable position that they will hold to those. That they won't mean that the switch to digital libraries is something we pay for with our privacy.
Library privacy laws were written before there was a digital library, and they're written for public libraries. Cohen says that Google could easily build consumer protections in their policies.
In some ways, it's very little to ask Google to do. I mean, we're not saying that if the courts say Google has to turn it over, we're not telling Google they have to defy a court order. We're just saying that Google has to try to protect people's privacy. And if they fail, then I think taking this case to the Congress and the various legislative bodies becomes a much more powerful case to do.
Cohen hopes Google will step up and institute privacy protections on their own.
We really have traditionally protected reading privacy as one of the really high points of people's privacy protections. And I just think it would be a shame if we let that slip away from us as we move to the digital age.
For more information about Google's book search service and the Electronic Frontier Foundation's efforts to protect consumer privacy, go to EFF.org. And now a commentary by Media Minute's own Candace Clement.
In a passionate speech in Colorado on Tuesday night, former CBS News anchor Dan Rather called on President Obama to form a White House commission on journalism and public media. Citing declining investment in investigative journalism and the loss of news outlets that regularly monitor institutions of power, Rather said that all citizens should be concerned about the crisis in journalism. A democracy and free people cannot thrive without a fiercely independent press, he said. Indeed, this would not be the first commission to take up the issue of public media. In 1967, a Carnegie Foundation-backed commission released a landmark report, Public Television, a Program for Action. The commission recognized that a public television, and later public radio system, was necessary to provide an instrument for the free communication of ideas in a free society. The commission's report was quickly taken up by President Johnson's administration, and within 9 months, the Public Broadcasting Act, which established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was passed into law. A new commission that focuses on the unique demands and opportunities of today's media landscape has the potential to project a broad new vision for public media in the digital age. Public media may provide some of the critical journalism our democracy needs, but it is continuously hamstrung by a vicious cycle of paltry funding. The United States spends just $1.35 per person on public media, compared to more than $80 per person in the UK and $100 per person in Denmark and Finland. And most public media programming does not yet reflect the true diversity of the nation. These important issues around funding and diversity, as well as the governance and expansion of the public media system, require attention from Washington if we are ever to create a public media that meets the needs of the American people.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with Dr. Ann Sheets, a Chicago-area physician, to discuss the debate in the United States in 2009 over healthcare and a proposed single-payer healthcare system. The following interview was recorded on Friday, July 31st, 2009.
We are joined on the phone by Dr. Ann Sheets. Dr. Sheets is a practicing physician in the Chicago area who is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program and is also the Chicago co-chair of the Illinois Single Payer Coalition. And she is joining us on the phone from Chicago. Dr. Sheets, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you're a part of a group that's involved with what's called single payer healthcare. And single payer is getting some mention as of late amidst the debate regarding possible changes to the healthcare program in the United States. For folks who may be unfamiliar, let's just start with a basic question. What is single-payer healthcare?
Single-payer healthcare is healthcare that is publicly financed and privately delivered, like our traditional Medicare program. So what we would do is extend Medicare, an improved version of Medicare that would cover everything, all necessary medical care. We would extend that to every person in the country from birth to death. That's a simple way of describing it. And we call it single payer because all of the money for healthcare is put into one pot, and that out of that pot, all of the providers of healthcare are paid. So we get rid of the multiple private insurance companies, all of whom have their own bureaucratic structures, and all of whom are trying to get the least expensive, the healthiest patients for themselves and make sure somebody else takes care of the sick.
Okay. In some of the, right around the beginning of 2009, there was some discussion about possible trajectories regarding where the national healthcare debate and the reform may go. There seemed to be some very early antagonism from people from high levels in government who were going to shape this. One particular instance regarding one quote I remember had to do with the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, a senator from Montana, Max Baucus, who said up front and publicly, single payer is off the table. Why is there antagonism, if it sounds like it'd be really cool? Why is there antagonism from positions on high?
Well, one obvious reason is that all of the people who hold office, most of them, not all of them, but certainly many, and certainly many people at the top of both parties, take money from the for-profit healthcare industry. So that includes the insurance industry. Certainly Max Baucus has taken a lot of money from the health insurance industry. It also involves the pharmaceutical industry that makes large contributions. And then there's another section of the for-profit healthcare industry that includes things like for-profit home health agencies, for-profit dialysis centers. All of those, they are not in favor of a single-payer program, and they have money to back that up. And some people, I think, don't understand it, and some just have this attitude that anything that government does is bad, even though I believe those people would not dare to go out and say, let's get rid of Medicare or let's get rid of 911, both of which are government programs. But that's just their attitude. Anything that government does is bad, so we shouldn't do it.
I actually just read a column by Paul Krugman, the noted New York Times columnist, where he actually quotes someone who said, I want government, words to the effect of, I want government to get their hands off of Medicare. Not realizing, of course, that, well, as you had just mentioned, Medicare is a government program.
Right. Actually, my husband had an elderly woman say to him at a meeting he went to, I don't want the government getting between me and my Medicare. That's how confused some people are.
Well, I mean, this might actually be a little segue regarding Medicare. Medicare is basically the program regarding covering of health insurance for folks at 65 and above, correct?
That's correct, and some younger people with disabilities.
I suppose a little bit of history might be in order. How did we get Medicare despite the fact that we've got this antagonism for what we're basically calling for an extension of Medicare? How did that happen?
Well, I don't think you would want me to go into the whole lengthy history of healthcare financing in this country, but Lyndon Johnson was the person who was able to get Medicare through, and we all know that he was a genius at getting legislation when he set out to do it. And let's remember that Medicare was passed, and in fact, we just celebrated the 44th anniversary of Medicare being signed yesterday. It was passed, and within a year, and this is in pre-computer days, all of the elderly people in the country were enrolled in that. And that required all of the hospitals in the country being inspected, because at that time it was common for hospitals to segregate black and white patients, and that was not allowed under Medicare. So this is something that can be done. This in pre-computer days, all of the elderly people in the country were entered into Medicare, and within a year, it was functioning. And it's a brilliant program. It continues to function very well to this day. I'm a geriatrician myself. I do home visits to frail elderly people who can't get out for medical care. I basically accept almost nothing except regular Medicare as primary insurance, because that's the only reliable payer for my service, and it works extremely well.
I guess a little bit of history might be in order regarding single payer. Single payer is the way in which the preferred way of handling healthcare in much of the industrialized world, as I understand it. But why don't we have it?
Well, again, I don't think you'd want me to go into the whole history of this, but our private insurance system is kind of an accident that developed. It has a long history, but much of it developed during World War II, when there were wage and price controls in effect, so that employers could not increase wages in order to attract workers, and they were allowed to offer benefits that were not taxable. So one of the benefits that they began to offer was health insurance through their employers. And at that time, previous to World War II, and I don't know the exact dates when the changeover occurred, but the Blue Cross Blue Shield companies were the first large insurers, and they were not for profits. They had community ratings, so in a particular community, everybody who joined a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan paid the same rate. It was considered unethical to charge people different rates based on their on pre-existing conditions or any other demographic feature. So that was a common form of the first form that was common of financing health care. Then as employers began to offer health care, commercial insurers came in and began to offer to insure working people, who of course are healthier than the whole community, because people who are not healthy are very often not able to work, and they would offer lower rates to employers based on the health of the populations in their companies. So then you begin to see the deterioration of community rating and the not-for-profit companies, because they were having to raise their rates in order to cover the care of the sick people who were left to them, at the same time that the commercial insurers were decreasing their rates based on covering mostly healthy people. So, and since then, we've had a deterioration in our financing system where even the not-for-profits have to compete on the same basis as the for-profit insurance companies, all of them trying to get the healthy patients and dump the sick patients. And that has resulted in the terrible state of healthcare financing that we have now.
And you find now, more than 60 years after the fact, and actually for quite a while, that there are and have been a number of groups, and we've mentioned two of them that you've been part of,
and still are, in fact, that are working on this. So what's been the status about agitation on the grassroots level for a single-payer system in the United States? And it seems like that's the only impetus for it. You're not seeing it at all from more powerful sectors. It's just been the grassroots. Is that correct?
It's mostly in the grassroots. Of course, John Conyers has been introducing H.R. 676, the single-payer health care bill, for some years. But yes, this is a grassroots effort. Physicians for a National Health Program, and if I could just mention the website in case people want to look up more information.
Yes, of course.
What we advocate is pnhp.org, very simple, the initials of Physicians for a National Health Program. It was formed in 1987, and the physician's proposal for a national health program was published in the early 90s, and if I recall, that original publication was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And Physicians for a National Health Program is a group of physician scholars, many of them primary care physicians, who have done very extensive research and analysis on healthcare financing and how it can work, how it has worked or failed to work in this country as well as in other countries. So that's the underlying basis on which we work. And then, yes, Physicians for a National Health Program, Healthcare Now, a national citizens group, the National Nurses Organizing Committee, a national nurses organization, and many local organizations such as the Chicago Single Payer Action Network and the Illinois Single Payer Coalition are working to educate people wherever we can. So we hold rallies, pass out literature, we go to churches, community groups, League of Women Voters, Democratic Party organizations. If the Republicans invite us, we're certainly happy to talk to them as well. We'll go anywhere to educate people.
So it's not just trying to limit yourself to folks who you think might be more receptive to your message. You'll talk to anyone who'll listen.
Well, and we're happy to talk to anyone. We're happy to engage in debate with anyone who's willing to talk with us. We're happy to do that. We think that there's no question that for reasonable people, our plan is going to emerge as the one that they think will be successful and that they should support.
There, since Barack Obama has been inaugurated President of the United States, there has been not only movement for a reform of national health care, but also it would seem a marked increase of activity, as well as the emergence of new groups that have been working on matters pertaining not just to health care, but to single payer. I take it that this is correct as well.
Yes, that's correct.
Yet, nonetheless, despite this increase of activity, you never or almost never hear this within the major American media. For example, just this past week from when we're recording, the New York-based media watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, actually just dropped off a major petition at the foot of the ABC broadcast headquarters in New York City, basically to critique ABC News because they've been giving practically no coverage, but that they're not alone in this, but they've been giving particularly no coverage regarding this. And on the rare instances when you see that there is coverage, at least in my mind, it's almost always described in very shrill or offensive terms. It's like a form of creeping socialism, as one person calls it. What's your take with regards to the media involvement here, their coverage, and whether or not they're playing a role in its in the advancement or suppression of single payer?
Oh, I do think the major media is playing a role in the suppression of single payer. And again, they're part of the, this immense corporate establishment that we have, where their kind of knee-jerk reaction to everything is we don't want the government intruding on our lives. We want to do whatever we want. And then there is, of course, the fact that Blue Cross Blue Shield and Aetna and Cigna advertise in the major media. So that's another reason for them not to cover it.
And that's another thing. It's like there's this, I guess you could go even deeper to a rhetoric of freedom, that I don't want my freedom of choice being impinged on. And yet in the wake of, and this might be another set of questions here, the other corporate control and corporations basically being these all-powerful fiefdoms, as it were, where you don't really have much of a say within the corporate control, and where the structure is set up so that a lot of people don't have a whole lot of freedom. What's your take on that?
Well, certainly, I'm just going to stick to the healthcare system, although, of course, this has implications for the rest of our lives too. But within the healthcare system, when you have corporate control of healthcare, as with the health insurance industry, they, in fact, the only choice that they give you is a choice of what to give up. You can have, you can have medication coverage, or you can have lesser deductibles on your hospital stays, or, you know, for the amount of money you have to spend, you have to choose what you're going to do without. And that's not necessary with the huge amount of money that we spend in this country on healthcare. We don't have to give up any of those things. We have enough money to cover all reasonably necessary medical care for every person in this country for the amount of money that we are spending. And under a single-payer program, the choices that people would have are the meaningful choices. That is, your doctor, your hospital, your home health agency, you could go to anyone that you wanted to because everybody's in the same plan. As it is now, most people now have restrictions on their choice of doctors and hospitals and other providers, because if you choose somebody that is out of network to your health plan, you have to pay more. So we want to get back to genuine choices. People who are concerned about government, what I would say about government as compared to corporate control, of course you don't trust the government to take care of you. Government requires people to be active. And I hope that is one of the lessons that our country will learn from the healthcare debate, is that we have to be involved in government in order to make it responsive to us. We cannot trust it. On the other hand, you have no control whatsoever over what health insurance companies do. We can't get active and intervene and make the health insurance companies provide us with what we need. That's impossible. We can do that with government if we're willing to be involved. That's what we're about.
What's been the status, one last question on this kind of corporate theme. What's been the status regarding concentration of corporations? Like, it would seem that the idea of choice might be better if you had, dozens upon dozens of corporations who were vying for your services and your involvement. But it would seem like that's been shrinking to the point where there are just a few providers. Is that the case? Do you know?
As for providers of health insurance, yes, it certainly is the case. There's been a lot of consolidation and mergers, and that's to be expected. But also on the question of people competing, health insurance companies competing, the only thing that health insurance companies compete on is how to dump sick patients and get more healthy patients. So that's just the opposite of what a health program is about, a national health program is about, which is providing care for sick people. That's just the opposite of what the private health insurance industry is about.
What?
Yes, there have been mergers, and there are very few companies now that dominate the whole country as far as providing health insurance.
What's the opinion of doctors, by and large, with regards to a single-payer health plan?
Well, a study that was published in, I believe it was the Annals of Internal Medicine last year, showed that about 60% of physicians favor a single-payer national health program. And that was an increase of about 10 from, I think, the previous study several years ago had found about 50% of doctors. So there's been an increase in the number of doctors favoring a single-payer program. And that's obviously because the present system is terrible for doctors, especially for primary care physicians, but for everybody. And Physicians for a National Health Program itself, I believe, has about 16,000 members, and that's a growing organization.
Where most people think of doctor organizations, they're actually apt to think of, and you actually mentioned it, the AMA, the American Medical Association, which is headquartered right here in Chicago. What's been their stance with regards to single payer?
They have not favored single payer. But then they did not favor Medicare either. And Medicare was a great boon for physicians. It boosted physicians' incomes. All of a sudden, a large group of people who are the sickest in the country, you could get paid for taking care of them. And it's no longer the case. It used to be the case that doctors could be poor. You could die poor. That's no longer the case. Not every physician may get paid as much as he or she wants, but nobody lives in poverty. And that's because now we can get paid for taking care of sick people. And certainly under a single-payer program, the highest paid specialist might have to accept less money, but we would, whoever we took care of, we would get paid for that. I just think that the AMA is just out of it. The shrinking organization,
yeah.
And they do not speak for the majority of physicians. I don't think they even understand. I don't know who they are, for one thing, but I don't think they understand what life is like for practicing physicians.
Let's talk strategy. So there are efforts afoot, and you mentioned one of them, H.R. 676, an amendment brought by Representative from Michigan, John Conyers, to help to introduce specifically single-payer health care. Yet you're seeing negotiations from various agencies in Congress to assemble a bill to reform Congress. Where does single-payer lie in that minefield, if you can briefly summarize that terrain?
Well, we just stand firm on working for single-payer because we know that that's the only thing that can work. And the attempts in Congress to produce something called a public plan, we do not support that. For one thing, I don't think it's going to pass because everybody who opposes the single-payer plan also opposes public option as part of a general, a different kind of health care reform. So I don't think one has any more chance than the other, and we should just go for what we know will work. A public option, it's not going to work in the sense it's not going to cover everybody. It's not going to extend coverage for health care to everybody. It's not going to control costs so that health care is affordable. It's not going to protect people against financial disaster if they get a serious illness. And I don't even think that it's going to be operational in the form that they're talking about now. The original idea for a public option was that everybody in the country who did not have health insurance, and maybe people on public aid and some other groups as well, would automatically be put into the public plan. So you would start out, as you did with Medicare originally, with a plan that already had a large number of people in it, and then it would be relatively easy to have to secure providers who wanted to take care of them and so on. If you start out with and it would be large enough that you could have, you could negotiate prices and have some ways of holding costs under control, although it still would not get rid of the very wasteful bureaucracy of the private health insurance industry, which means that the cost savings would be very minimal. But what you have now is a very weakened version of that apparently, of course, we still don't know exactly how it's going to come out, but apparently it's going to start with no providers and no patients, and then somebody has to go out and try to draw both of those groups into the plan. I just don't see how something like that can work. So we know it can't work. You know, similar things have been tried. We know nothing that keeps the private insurance industry involved can work to control costs or to provide everybody with access to health care. So we stand firm with working for single payer no matter how long it takes to get there.
If there's a silver lining to what may be going on now regarding healthcare, there's one amendment that's been brought to my attention regarding a representative from Cleveland, Ohio, who has actually also run for president a number of times, Dennis Kucinich. He's brought, as I understand it, an amendment that might help in this regard, where we could offer the option for single-payer healthcare on a state level. Can you explain this?
Yes, that's correct. In many states in the country have groups of people working for single-payer programs at the state level. So we're working on both of those levels, working for a national bill and at the same time working for bills in the states, because we think either of those could be the way for the single-payer program to advance. It could start in some of the states, and we think once it did, everybody would say, I want the same thing. That would be a big impetus to go ahead and put it through nationally. Or on the other hand, it could be that the pressure from the states will just mean that it will go through on the national level first.
And it bears worth reminding that that's actually how the Canadian single-payer healthcare system, that sometimes touted as a socialist boogeyman, actually began. And it actually began first in the province of Saskatchewan before it was actually implemented nationwide in Canada.
Absolutely. That's correct.
And I guess this might be the hardest question I'll ask. And it might be foolish of me to ask, but I'll ask it anyway. Open up your crystal ball, if you would, please. Where do you foresee the future of the struggle with regards to single payer? One friend of mine who talked about this maybe a month or so ago when I had a conversation with him kind of regards single payer as probably an inevitability. He thinks it will happen and it's just a matter of time. What do you think?
I agree with that. I think that it's inevitable because I don't see how our country can survive with some people losing their homes so that the executives of health insurance companies can take home million-dollar bonuses. I just don't think that that can, a country that works that way can survive. I don't think that people will stand for it. I wish that single payer would come sooner because it would save a great deal of suffering. But if it doesn't, I agree with it that it is inevitable, and that's what we'll keep working for.
That was an interview with Dr. Ann Sheets, recorded on July 31st, 2009. The website for the Illinois Single Payer Coalition is ilsinglepayercoalition.org. The website for Physicians for a National Health Program is www.pnhp.org.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.